TomDispatch.com. This is TomCast. Interviews and insight from Tom Dispatch contributors, bringing you a deeper understanding of our post-9/11 world and a clear sense of how our global imperial system actually works. I'm Timothy McBain. This week, I was fortunate enough to be able to sit in on a conversation between Tom Engelhardt, editor of Tom Dispatch, and Jonathan Schell, Nation Institute Fellow and author of, among other books, The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of Nuclear Danger. Tom and Jonathan discussed U.S. involvement in Vietnam and Afghanistan and U.S. nuclear policy from the 1960s to the present.
You know, Jonathan, here we are. We're both veterans of the anti-war movement in the Vietnam years, and you covered the Vietnam War. You classically wrote the book The Military Half, where you spent time in a plane over South Vietnam, a forward spotter plane, and the village of Ben Suk, and other works from that period. That's 35 years ago. Now, if you were told in 1975, when that war ended, that some 35 years later, the United States would be in its 9th or 10th year of a war in another third world, as we used to call it, peasant land. It would be in a full-scale counterinsurgency mode. There would be another 100,000 American troops there. It would not be doing well, and so on and so forth. How would you have reacted? What would you have thought?
Well, of course, with astonishment. Of course, it's not one war, but two wars, because we have the one in Iraq just for good measure. Yes, it's especially astonishing. If you think back to that Vietnam period, that war ended with a sort of finality that sometimes is forgotten, because it was really capped by the driving from office of Richard Nixon in Watergate. And it was widely understood that that event was connected with his sort of pursuit of the of victory in Vietnam long after the country had turned against it for various reasons, led to them establishing the Plumbers and so forth. So, in other words, the verdict upon the Vietnam War was very, very deep. It certainly included public opinion. It included elites. It included the military, which had been devastated by that war and knew it, and really took a sort of never again pledge. And that was reflected in the Powell strategy. Don't go into a war without a political objective. Make sure to have an exit strategy and a bunch of other rules. So these lessons of Vietnam were not perfunctory. They were deeply absorbed into the body politic. So the astonishing thing is that then there began a process of de-learning them. In other words, they were peeled back and rejected in a very almost a semi-conscious process. And I think it was this process that led us back to a point at which two more wars, such wars, became possible.
You know, it's interesting that the Bush administration, it's now quite obvious that they played an opposites game with Vietnam.
Yeah, well, I think that was part of the de-learning. In other words, it was going to be the anti-Vietnam. It was going to be the un-Vietnam that would undo the so-called lessons of Vietnam, which, of course, had been styled as a syndrome.
But, you know, it's strange, as you just reminded me, the other part of it that I hadn't really thought about is the Bush administration came to power. Cheney, in particular, the people around Cheney, with an incredible determination to also de-learn Watergate. That is the other half of it, the Nixon half of it. They were going to not only turn back the global thing, they were going to turn back the Washington part of it as well.
Yeah, well, absolutely, and they did, and therefore inaugurated such things as the wiretapping program, the program of torture, really trying to restore and succeeding in restoring the whole imperial presidency, which had been somewhat discredited. And I think that what that points to is the heart of what was going on there, and that was that these were lessons. Fundamentally, and this is hardly a new thing to say, but about limits on American power. And they were specific limits. And they were limits in the ability of the United States to go into other countries and determine their political futures. In other words, limits on imperialism, limits on imperial projects. And I think the de-learning occurred with a motive. And the motive was to restore not just the ability to intervene, not just the imperial presidency, with all its powers and violations of power, but the American imperial project. They wanted to get back on that track, and they succeeded in that. Of course, 9/11 gave them the green light.
When you look at the first year, in any case, or so, of the Obama presidency, when it comes to both the imperial presidency part of it and the foreign wars part of it, are we in a learning, a de-learning? And what are we learning or de-learning? What's actually, how do you look on what's happened since Bush left power?
Obviously, Obama was elected by people who opposed both wars, who certainly were infuriated by the violations of civil liberties and so forth. And yet, he has allowed so much of that to persist, actually stepping up the Afghan war and sort of coasting along with the Iraq war in a way that's hard to predict what will happen and so forth. So these policies are somehow deeply entrenched in some way that's hard to really analyze or understand.
Let's take up that word entrenched, because in your lifetime, you have been pursuing one subject, one deeply entrenched thing in our world, and that is the power of nuclear power, the dangers of nuclear power. You wrote a best-selling book, The Fate of the Earth, about nuclear weapons. And one of the striking things is that not only is that imperial urge deep, deep in our society, but nuclear power, that terrifying, mad war of all our years in the Cold War, is also seemingly deeply entrenched and ongoing, even though without the Soviet Union, there might seem to be no reason for it. You've just written a Nation cover story where you return to many of these themes. And I know that on Thursday, April 8th, the Ethical Culture School in New York, you, Dan Ellsberg, Phil Donahue, and others are going to have a night talking about this. But I'd like you to just talk a little about why nuclear weapons are so deeply entrenched in our world.
You know, my answer might be surprising to you, because if I ask myself, why does the United States insist on keeping thousands of nuclear weapons more or less indefinitely on hair trigger alert? And by the way, the new START treaty that's about to be signed will set a limit of 1,550, which is a reduction. Nevertheless, it leaves you facing 1,550 Russian weapons and pointing a like number back at them. But what I want to say is that I realize that if somebody were to say to me, why does the United States want to have an arsenal of 1,550? I don't know what the answer is. I don't think there's a rational answer, in the sense that obviously we have no enmity with Russia that would justify such a deployment. I mean, all logic would point to cutting, you know, if not to zero, then to a couple of hundred or whatever some minimal number would be, and then turn to the other nuclear
powers.
Which
could still basically destroy the planet.
Which still could do unbelievable damage. And I would argue we should go actually to zero, but of course that involves bringing in the other nuclear powers as well. But the point is that, so that reason really doesn't exist anymore, because you could negotiate them away, so to speak, or at least you could try to, which we do not. What other reason? Do we imagine that we need 1,550 nuclear weapons to counter proliferations? Even one weapon is useless for those purposes. So what? I don't think there's a rational reason, and I don't know what the reason actually is.
The great explanation for nuclear arsenals on either side in the Cold War, as you point out in your new book, was deterrence. The question is, what exactly do nuclear weapons deter now? Explain deterrence.
Well, I think there's almost some intellectual dishonesty in it, because very obviously the key thing, not the only thing, but the key thing that they're meant to deter is other nuclear weapons. And if you ask, where are the other nuclear weapons? Well, of course, when you speak of hundreds or thousands of them, those are in one country only, which is Russia. So obviously the idea is that we're deterring Russia. But the fact of the matter is that the number of American nuclear warheads is now a figure that is negotiated with Russia. So the question isn't really, does the United States need some nuclear weapons to counter those that just happen to be in Russia? The question is, what figure should the United States advance as the joint one together with the Russians? And if you look at the recent START negotiations, which it's good that they draw the numbers down from 2,200 to 1,550 as a limit, but they permit that 1,550 to remain for another 7 years. In other words, we're going to arrive almost at 3 decades after the Cold War with 1,550 Russian warheads pointed at our noses and a like number pointed at their noses. Now, what is that all about? Is there anything, and I suggest there is not, in the relationship between the United States and Russia that could justify such a thing? There's got to be some other reason. Maybe they're the bureaucratic ones. It's very hard to say.
But, you know, strangely enough, I feel somewhat the same thing about, for instance, the Afghan war. I mean, we're fighting it. It's deeply entrenched in our world. The Bush people, that is the older crew, had an explanation for why we were fighting. I mean, they had explanations they both offered and explanations they didn't offer, but that were clearly there. Now we're fighting in Afghanistan, and except for a little bit of retread 9/11 stuff, it's kind of unclear why that war is going on. I mean, it's kind of similar in a way. There's some sense in which they're just doing it because it has its own impetus, its own momentum, something like that.
And by the way, that momentum is not popular support, because popular support turned against the war in Afghanistan. I don't know, it sort of meanders around now, a little bit for, a little bit against.
Jonathan, it's 2012. There's a heated presidential race going on. You are given the job at The Nation of looking back on the Obama presidency, that first-term presidency, not knowing if he'll have a second term or not. What do you think you'll be saying then about war and nuclear weapons in Obama?
Right now, I'd have to say that he announced the proper goal, but he didn't seize the moment to take the actual steps that would turn it into a reality. So far, he has not.
If you were in the White House right now, Jonathan Schell president, and you had your moment to be decisive, what would you do on nuclear weapons? I mean, exactly how would you proceed?
I think that what's centrally and basically needed is a real and believable commitment and plan put forward, proposed by the United States to the other nuclear powers and to the world at large, to move to a world free of nuclear weapons on a certain date. Let it be 2020. Let it be 2025. I don't care so much about the time frame. And then to sketch out the steps and the stages for reaching that goal. Get reactions from the Russians, from the Chinese, from the Indians, the Pakistanis, but announce that goal as a very serious intention. And then if you could reach agreement on that, you would have the nuclear powers all on the same page and with a kind of united will. You would be able to go to countries that might be considering proliferation and saying, look, the world is seriously getting out of this business. We really mean to do this. So you mustn't get into it. And I think that this would give a kind of strength to the non-proliferation efforts, as well as the disarmament efforts that they now entirely lack. Because right now what you have is a kind of disarray when you approach proliferation, because the United States will propose something, China and Russia will say no, or they don't want anything quite as strong as that, and it all goes nowhere. But if you had that commitment in place, you'd have a kind of unity, which would, by the way, include all of the non-nuclear weapon states who already favor a world without nuclear weapons. And I think it would generate a kind of united will that would actually solve the problem in a few decades.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan. I just want to remind listeners that you'll be talking on April 8th at 7 o'clock at the Ethical Culture School in New York with Dan Ellsberg and others about nuclear issues. Do you want to give us a little preview?
really the idea of the event is that we've reached a kind of turning point, a new moment in the nuclear age. And all the nuclear pots on the stove are boiling right now. We have the negotiations and the START negotiations, the nuclear posture review. We have the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference coming up in May. Things are boiling away in Iran and North Korea, and we're going to try to look at the thing as a whole and figure out what direction things are headed in.
Well, glad to have you with us.
If you'd like to read more, Jonathan Schell's article, Reaching Zero, is the cover story in this week's Nation magazine, which you can also access online at thenation.com. And remember, Schell will be appearing this Thursday at 7 p.m. with Daniel Ellsberg and others in a panel discussion moderated by Phil Donahue. The event is free and open to the public. It will be held at the New York Society for Ethical Culture Auditorium on 64th Street and Central Park West. Doors open at 6:30. I'm Timothy McBain. Thanks for listening.